our session entitled Musician and the Scientist Writes a Code, Protocols for Communication and Openness. I will make a very brief introduction of Creative Commons and some of the protocols that have been proposed and needed to cover some use cases which were not covered by the Creative Commons licenses. And then I will invite all of you, because we are not that many people, to introduce themselves and explain briefly the interest in the session, what they're expecting from the session, and how these things can contribute. And then we already have the first name of the first person who will take the floor. It's Tim Nguyen, who's counsel for Science Commons, and will explain the process, both in terms of content, substance, and procedure, how Science Commons came to the conclusion that Creative Commons licenses were not necessarily adapted for open data, which is first use case. And what's going to be done next. So just a quick check, do I need to explain the Creative Commons licenses, or is it clear for everybody? It's clear for everybody. Very good.
I think it's clear to me, but I actually would say you should probably run through it anyway, just because people might not feel comfortable explaining it.
I'd be curious to know about the Science Commons specifically.
This would be the first presentation. So basically, Creative Commons provides a set of licenses which offer more generous terms than the direct which is applicable by default. And there is a nice user-friendly interface which allows authors to use between various options, attribution, non-commercial, non-derivative and share-alike, and at the end you receive some piece of HTML code that you can apply on your website next to your work in order to describe to the public which uses they can make with your work. So these licenses are based on applicable copyright law and in addition the law by granting more permissions. So maybe, Tim, you'd like to start now with some background on Science Commons. So I would like also to introduce Arash Sal, who is working for CC Learn and will also explain what are some requirements for education in terms of open licensing. Paul Keller from Creative Commons Netherlands may tell us more about use cases that happened in the Netherlands. Well, so basically after having discussed many years with licensed users, stakeholders, we noticed that licenses may not be the most appropriate tools and a complete solution to cover the needs for all creators, for all authors, for all researchers. And I think that's why Creative Commons came with additional protocols in order to cover the use cases which were not best and fully certified by the licenses. So in a nutshell, those use cases are scientific research, science, education, maybe also public sector information, publicly funded research, publicly funded works, and all kinds of data.
Now, first question, do you want me to go down there or do you want me to talk here? Do you want to hear me from here?
Can you use your mic?
Is the mic working? Hello? as long as you can hear me. So I'll just leave it then. So just a few seconds about what Science Commons is. The Science Commons is an internal project of Creative Commons. It's not a separate organization, but it's a focus group within Creative Commons to look at how we can apply some of the lessons we learned from Creative Commons to science. And the shorthand that I use for it is open science, which is actually the way science has always been, until recently when we've seen more intellectual property rights start to be applied on top of the way that we share materials, data, and scholarship in science. So in terms of what we do, we take the core of what we use are the Creative Commons licenses, and then we try to extend those a little bit. But that's the core legal tools we use are the same, but we try to find ways that can be a solution for scientists. And our constituency is really scientists, because that's what we want to enable. So in terms of the Creative Commons licenses, the most obvious place they're used in sciences is in the open access journals in science. BioMed Central has 140 journals under Creative Commons licenses. Public Library of Science has 7 or 8 journals under Creative Commons licenses. And recently, the Rockefeller Foundation has put their very prestigious Journal of Cell Biology under Creative Commons licenses. So in the scholarship area, that's where the Creative Commons licenses apply to science. But beyond that, scientists don't just need access to publications, they also need access to data. They also need access to the raw materials, like cell lines and mice and plasmids and other things. So those are the kinds of things that we work to enable scientists to share. And we use some of the same ideas of using standard licensing, using metadata, using human readable deeds to make these tools more accessible to scientists and to help them to negotiate with these things. So that's my 5 seconds of Science Commons. If you want to know more, please see me later or check out our website. So let me just jump now to CC0 and how this all started. This has been a long journey for us. We spent a lot of time in the woods before we came to where we are now. And before I kind of outline that, let me make a strong claim, which is that if you accept 3 goals that we accept, then the conclusion that we've reached, the CC0 approach, is inevitable. And those 3 goals are: we want a tool that's easy for scientists to use and understand. So we don't want to have something that's so complex that we need to hire a law firm to help you use. And that's the first goal. The second goal is that it has to be legally accurate. It can't be a tool that ignores the way the law works or causes people to make systematic errors about the law. So that's the second goal. And the third goal should be that it's an approach that has the lowest possible transaction costs. It shouldn't impose burdens on scientists when they share data. It should work pretty much the way the scientists expect to share data now. So if you accept those 3 goals, that's my claim, then you will be led inevitably to the approach that we've chosen for CC0, which is, the way that I would summarize it is that it's a quit claim deed. Actually, it was more complicated in the beginning, but we split it out. There's a waiver piece and there's an assertion piece. I'll talk about the assertion piece later in dynamic time, but the waiver piece is what I'm talking about now. That's what you have to have if you accept those 3 goals and just explain or just elucidate. So where we were, we started about 2 years ago with something called the Science Commons or Creative Commons database FAQ. The reason we wrote the FAQ is because people were coming to us and saying, we'd like to apply Creative Commons licenses to our database. And we looked at some of the databases, and there were a protein database. There was no copyrightable content there, so how can we apply Creative Commons license on top of it? What would that mean? It wasn't clear to us. So we came out with a set of recommendations called the Database FAQ. And it was adopted by a project called UniPro, UNIPROT. They still have this policy, so we can check out what they say. But the bottom line was that the Database FAQ recommended that you can apply a Creative Commons license only to the extent that there was copyright. And that's what their policy says. But to the extent that there's copyright, we apply a Creative Commons license and no derivatives license to their database. So, fine and good, but a lot of scientists came to us and said, well, here's the problem. We can't figure out what a database is subject to copyright. And it's not just because they're not lawyers, because lawyers can't figure out when a database is subject to copyright. So let's just assume for simplicity's sake, the database has no copyrightable content in terms of the data pieces are not like music files or pictures or things that obviously are copyrighted. Let's say they're just data. So would there be copyright in the US? Well, there may be, assuming that the overall construction of the database itself is sufficiently creative, has expressed elements of the data pieces. But that's not the end of it, because a lot of the way that we share data is global. And if you go to Canada, they say, well, the standard is not creativity, the standard is whether or not you use reasonable, you exercise judgment and skill in the selection of the database elements. If so, then you get copyright in your database. And then you go to Australia, and you say, well, it's not judgment and skill, it's whether or not you have sweated the brow, industriousness. And then you go to Europe, and they say, well, if you have a substantial investment in the database, we'll give you sui generis protection of the database on top of copyright protection. So all around the world, there are very different regimes that look at database copyright very differently. So how do you create a single thing, a single license that accurately reflects all the different data regimes, data copyright protection regimes around the world? Can't. China, for example, doesn't use any of these. They use unfair competition laws to protect the extraction of data from databases. So if you look at that, you think, well, so how are we going to make a set of recommendations that one is easy for scientists to use and apply, that takes into account all of these different regimes? You can't. Like, the only way you can do it is to do a quick claim read, which is to say, to the extent that I have rights anywhere in the world, I give them up. I may not even know what rights I have, but I'd like to give them up because I'd like to enable this sharing that makes it easy for scientists to get what they want. So if you go back to my three principles, let's say that you wanted to keep copyright or reserve copyright. Could you do it consistently with the way that copyright and database protections work around the world? Well, you could. You could still go back to the old way that we did it, which is say, you know, I apply a Creative Commons license to the extent that I have rights. But that would be gibberish. Nobody would understand it, including you. And you wouldn't know where you have rights. And so for the scientist who was trying to figure out, what do I need to comply with? It's impossible. So that violates my goal of simplicity and ease of understanding. Now let's say, I don't really care about whether or not it's easy or not. Those scientists should hire their own lawyers to help them figure it out. Well, that would violate the low transaction costs, because you'd have to either go to your own lawyer or go to your general counsel office and say, what is it that I need to do to comply here? More likely, the scientist is just going to say, well, I'm going to apply anyway. I can't figure out if there's a copyright there. But I'll treat it as if it has copyrights. And what that does is it extends these copyright restrictions to everything, including things that are not copyrightable. Congress said facts, ideas, and discoveries are not subject to copyright. That's actually a provision in the Copyright Act. So as a matter of law, we don't think of data that is purely factual as subject to copyright. But if we created a sharing regime where copyright was the default, and everyone assumed everything was subject to copyright, we could very well see that this notion of copyright licensing taking over vast chunks of the scientific enterprise where copyright is not traditionally applied and doesn't really accurately apply. So that's the second principle that would be violated. And the third is this notion of the scientist. And what is the scientist doing? Well, going back to the way that scientists work since, you know, maybe publishing got started in the 16th century, is scientists generally give up rights to IP in exchange for recognition. In exchange for saying, I made this discovery, I'm not going to reserve IP rights. And that has been very much the norm of science until recently, when with Bayh-Dole, universities started to reserve rights, and then you have this increasing view of the products of science as being subject to copyright patents and other things. But this is not the way that the core scientific enterprises worked in the past. And for many of the scientists that we talk to or the projects that we work with, this is not their view either. They don't want to reserve copyright. In fact, they want a tool that they can use to signal to the world that they're not reserving rights, so they can guarantee freedom. And so that's why I think that there are many ways to implement the ideas that I described. There's a project called the TALIS license, the open community license, it's called the public domain dedication license, it really pretty much does this. There's a lot of projects out there in terms of human genomics that already declare that everything is public domain. So this also complies with a little bit. And, so what we want to do is create a quit claim deed, a deed that says, to the extent that I have rights, I want to waive them, I want to signal to the world that I'm waiving them, and I'm not reserving any rights. And maybe that's not legally possible in every jurisdiction, but I think the important thing here is to signal that intention. Because increasingly, databases are global in scope. You have contributors from all around the world. And we need a way for you to clear the rights in that data because the rights come from different places and are complicated. So that's my 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Tim. Maybe before entering into the discussion, we could start by quick introductions, starting
in understanding more and contributing in general.
Catherine Monaghan, Wellesley College undergraduate.
I'm Federico Morando from Italy as well, and I'm interested in particularly in this Science Commons project and in databases especially, so this is why I chose.
I'm Arash Basola, I'm the director of CC Learn, the Education Division of Creative Commons.
I'm Caroline Lombrosini, and I'm working with Mallory in the Copyright for Libraries project.
I'm Mike Linkster, I work for Creative Commons.
I'm Eric Saltzman, and I'm a board member of Creative Commons, a lot of Creative Commons people.
I'm Tim Wynn, Council for Science Commons.
I'm Paul, and my microphone is working.
Broke.
Just one
smile. Oh, I'm Paul Keller from CC Netherlands.
Andy Sellers. I just graduated from Northeastern University, going on to George Washington Law, and a Creative Commons user.
My name is Jessica Walsh, and I'm working on various projects at the Berkman.
I'm Phil Malone. I run the Cyber Law Clinic at the Berkman Center.
I mean to say hi to Phil. I'm Emily Berger at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm intellectual property counsel there.
Rich Baronet with Connections, a big Creative Commons user, and as an engineering professor, I'm very interested in the area of open science.
I'm Allison Smith, I'm at WGBH, and I run the stock sales and licensing area.
I'm Jill Goldberg, I'm the rights manager at WGBH.
I'm Andrea Valli, I'm an undergrad student at the University of São Paulo, Brazil.
I'm Jeff Young, I'm a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Timmy Duran from CyberDevCon.
Thank you. Could you watch the presentation of licensing?
She says, I'm going to just be kind of brief. To follow up on what Tim said, one issue we have in education, particularly in science education, is that we're getting much, much more innovative in terms of what we consider educational material. So for example, whether it's K-12 or higher ed, a lot of science ed depends on utilizing real databases, right? People are going in and they're digging in and producing reports, right? And they're able to refer back to those data. Or for example, imagine a scientific study in a field that's not entirely quantitative. So there's subjective observations, photographs, that kind of thing that you might observe. Those have creative, right, juices that have gone into them and therefore probably are subject to copyright, and yet they're lumped in with all these other data that really aren't. And so from our perspective, there's a clear need for some kind of a product that enables people who want to do so to say, I just don't want to deal with the rights thing, right? It gets in the way. It makes everything that I'm hoping for in terms of what I would like to enable with these materials just more complicated. And so to the extent that we can produce something like CC0 that says, to the extent that I can, I would like to waive those rights, right, and allow it to go that's a clear, there's a clear demand for that among a lot of these sort of new projects. And I'll mention there's some other interesting twists in education, particularly in K-12. There are some things that are tied up with things like attribution, which are problematic. So attribution presumes that you're going to tell everybody who actually created it, who took this picture. What if you're an 8-year-old? That's a problem, right? The privacy laws and a variety of other things say, no, no, you can't do that. And so we're saying open things up, apply CC. Well, that's good as a concept, but the attribution becomes a real issue. And so to the extent, again, that CC0 or products like these can kind of say, well, there are these other rights that are also problematic. Maybe we can not have to deal with them so much if we use something like CC0.
I would add also that, you know, the Orphan Works legislation is currently pending in Congress, and I think that the people in this room are probably interested in having something like that passed. So, you know, I think it's a problem that it looks like not all of the artists are on board with that. But similarly, I think that you'll face that with the scientific community, that in order to create something widespread, we need to have, you know, widespread support, and the content needs to get in there. I'm actually also, you know, I'm happy to kind of talk offline with anyone who's interested in this. I'm a patent lawyer, and I'm working on creating a prior art repository. I'm thinking about some of the issues that you're thinking about, which is how do we bring over, you know, prior art that's been in existence for a long time that doesn't necessarily, that we don't know who the original author was anymore. We don't know who has the rights to that information. I'd really like to see this repository be free and accessible to everyone. And so, anyway, I would be interested in talking with folks about that later as well. But I haven't come up with an answer to that question yet.
Do you mean that for all Orphan Works, a rights waiver or a rights assertion that no rights apply, or that we don't know which rights apply, could be implemented by some sort of authority, like national libraries or other stakeholders? Is it this idea that you have in mind that you would like to discuss?
I guess I actually kind of had two comments in Orphan Works. I think is it's an issue that we still haven't figured out how to deal with, what copyright protections even exist if, you know, to someone who we don't know who the author is. And so I think that has to be dealt with, you know, in any capacity that you move forward with some type of new license, which is, if there was no person who's holding any rights, how can we ask them to give up any rights that they may have?
But also an issue with Orphan Works, particularly with documentaries, is that, you know, I mean, they're comprised of many third-party materials, and so you can't just sort of say, well, we're going to use it because all the rights belong to the people within them. And certainly, that's not the case for other kinds of works, I think, but for, you know, visual media, it's laden with third-party rights.
And I just point out, you know, we're not going to have enough time to discuss, obviously, everything, but in theory, the assertion piece, which Tim briefly mentioned, which is sort of a way of asserting facts about something. And the idea behind it was that things that are in the public domain, we don't have a good way of telling people that truth, right? And that if we could create a tool that enabled people who have the expertise to say, because of these things, I'm quite certain that this is available under these conditions, you could imagine taking that and amending it in a way that would work for an open source kind of system. That's going to require a lot more thinking, and we're still kind of tied up with some of the problems there, but it is a piece of this that we have to think about.
And actually, to your point, there is such a thing for music.
Right.
Online, you don't see this piece in the public domain, or is it?
Can you tell us more, just very briefly, about this online?
Oh, well, you know, I wish I could remember the URL, but
music is pretty,
you know, fun. Basically, it may just be PB Music. I apologize, I don't remember what the URL is, but I know that it exists and I've used it. And, you know, if you want to know his happy birthday, the public domain, you can check, and they have all kinds of, you know, so if, I suppose if you Googled, you know, public domain music, you would probably bring up the site. but anyway.
So it's a registry? Or?
Pardon? It's a registry, yeah. It tells you. I don't know who created it, but it exists.
PDinfo.com?
Yes, that's it, exactly. PDinfo.com, yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned happy birthday to you, because Professor Robert Bronwies at the George Washington University School of Law just wrote, I believe it was a 67-page paper on whether or not that is the case. So I hope when I go there next year, maybe I can ask him about it. But it's a long, extensive thing about the history and the mythology around it and things like that. But it highlights it definitely, like what you were saying about orphan works before, it becomes a very sort of salient issue, some form that we can make a formal, maybe a depository of, like, I believe this is the case, in a form where people can then go and challenge that claim.
On the note of kind of having to put things forward and allow people to challenge the claim, that creates a whole other set of, you know, legal issues. And so, I mean, I think that we're really, what Science Commons is trying to do here is figure out how can we create this new widespread system that works in all without creating new legal challenges. I don't know that that's possible. I mean, you'll certainly face, side issues that are going to stem from this, whatever it is. I don't mean to be the naysayer. I think certainly as what Larry Lessig puts it, he goes into things very pessimistic, and still they somehow worked out. But anyway.
Indeed, the beauty of this protocol, this rights waiver, is that it removes restrictions and also all interpretation issues, legal differences between countries, legal differences between material, between cultures of different rights holders and contributors. And indeed, the sole remaining barrier is legal restrictions in order to implement this legal openness. So we have to produce something which is simple but which will not be challenged the minute after by courts and by people who have divergent interests.
At the risk of offending all of the lawyers in the room, but I think we shouldn't be overly concerned about these things. Because, of course, the CC licenses and this tool are not only licenses, but they are more, I think, in the perception of most of the users, more of a social contract for people who use them. And if we've learned something from the last 4 or 5 years where the CC licenses are in place and where we've had all these discussions, if they indeed adequately deal with moral rights in the European jurisdictions, so that could be problematic, it has turned out not to be problematic. Because people don't jump on the weaknesses of the license. People with remarkable consistency use them as social tools which are expressions of good faith and kind of like guidelines for use. And of course we can come up and identify problems here, but I think the fact that we provide people with a tool which is reasonably well defined and which is trying to respect all the legal challenges as much as possible, and it's probably impossible to do for all of them, will give people many, many new ways of collaborating with that thing. It will empower people. We shouldn't just say that, because that tiny little bit of a very complex legal problem hasn't been worked out yet. We should be hesitant to release that into the world, because these licenses haven't been perfect. We're now with a normal license. We're at version 3.0, which incorporates some of the experience we had and what we thought we can express something clearer, or we have another way of dealing with it. So I'd be like a little bit more proactive in learning by doing.
And I don't mean to say otherwise. I think, you know, folks should go forth and be well, but we also have only 10 lawyers at EFF, so try to, you know, do it in a way that allows keeps your users off the hook. And I guess maybe I'm just suggesting that rather than going for the entire end goal of CC0, maybe it needs to at least be CC0 in the US, or you can only kind of confront so many legal challenges if that's what you're looking to protect. Otherwise, if you just decide to go ahead and go forth and see what happens, then you can say, what's the greatest barrier? We're going to try to overcome the greatest barrier. But you, I just don't see how you can say we're going to avoid all legal issues around the world, because they differ. And as of yet, we haven't yet figured out a way to have an international law that really works everywhere in any capacity. I mean, even I think ones where, you know, as humans, we can all agree that there should be basic human rights that apply internationally. We still struggle with that. And so I'm just kind of pointing out that constraint.
Okay, I have another answer to that.
Which is this, there was a decision made, which perfectly plays this contrast out, that unlike the existing suite of licenses, which were first developed for a particular jurisdiction, and but understood to apply globally, right? They all are global licenses. And then were adapted or ported, if you will, to these other places to show it's compatible internationally. The presumption here was we don't want a tool that has to march through that same process. Right? What we want is something that right from the get-go is understood to be universally applicable. And part of the logic in that is the very particular flavor of this, right? The way that we're thinking of the CC0 waiver is to the extent that we can, we are attempting to waive all rights. And so implicit in that is this assumption that there may be some variation and that that's okay. You know, it's like it's exactly what Paul said. So the spirit of it is understood to be part of this global thing. And if this country's jurisdiction says, no, no, you can't really do that with your moral rights, or this one says that you can't do that with whatever, it still sort of be like, well, but let's let that go, right? Let's see if this works just the same. It does beg the question, though, is that actually, first of all, the most obvious thing to do, and sort of compelling, and sort of agree with that? Or are there so many concerns about that? Because, you know, people would say, wait a minute, you know, even with that, it just won't work here, or it just won't work there. I mean, that would undermine the intent, right, by which people put that. And maybe we are better off saying, we got it, you know, we've got it locked down, this works perfectly in this area, now let's try and sort of force march it through the rest of the world. See if we can get it to apply more. It does apply with contrast.
And to continue on Paul's remark, instead of limiting the applicability to one jurisdiction, which also can be very dangerous because the whole world thinks that fair use is applicable, so this may not be a very, very good idea. So maybe it's best in order to have things moving and not write tens of essays about moral rights, etc., in order to see if this waiver is applicable, to start with a few communities, a few use cases who are in need of this social norm, because there's very few risk of problems of enforcement if this is the norm within the community and if this is what people are asking. So the two first aspects would be scientific data and education, but there's also potential for publicly owned information once authors are identified, maybe also for geographic data, these kinds of.
So, 2 points. One is the conferences that led to CC0 was a meeting in Paris at the Sorbonne, and the case study that we were looking at was an organization called GBIF, Global Biodiversity Information Facility. Really cool facility. They actually collect biodiversity data from all around the world. You can take one of their apps and put it on top of Google Maps and I'll show you where the different vaults are located around the planet. It's a really cool tool. And a lot of this is like basic observation of animals and plants and where they occur. And the facility itself is located, I believe, in Copenhagen. A lot of their data analysis collaborators are in the US and Europe. Many of their data sources are from countries like Brazil, India, China, Africa, all around the world. that is actually a pretty typical use case for the kind of thing that, CC0 needs to be. And so when you look at these cases, they kind of started to convince. I'm a real skeptic about this idea of post-geographic, web or something like that. But when you start to look at some of these data collaborations, they do kind of look post-geographic in the sense that you can't really figure out how do these jurisdictional limits apply to these cases. And the data come from all around the world, they're processed by people in different parts of the world. And so it is truly an international collaboration. If we were to release just a US tool, it would not address their needs or the needs of many of our scientific data collaborators. So that's the first point. And I guess the second point is that I suspect there are places where GPL is probably not enforceable in the world, but if that was an objection to releasing GPL, we wouldn't have limits, we wouldn't have open source, we wouldn't have the computer infrastructure we have today. So maybe that's more of the idea that that the perfect should not be that good.
Thank you.
Thank
Let's see if this thought is helpful. And I took Paul's point and Tim's last point that lawyers really are very good at spotting problems and sometimes stopping things from happening. On the other hand, people do look to lawyers to understand how they may move forward without running into problems. So what if CC0, if you thought of it as CC asymptote, and instead it was getting as close to giving all rights, relinquishing all rights as possible? And what if it was understood to be that? And what if the local jurisdictions, the local communities, engaged in explaining in their jurisdiction what that actually meant? So if, for example, in France they would deal with the moral rights issue, and there would be a discussion whether it would be possible to assign, to assign to an attorney in fact the ability to deal with that issue on behalf of the rights holder with instruction that she would, et cetera, make it as easy as possible, or whatever people could begin to figure out. Then the people would, if the local organizations were successful, understand both what they were giving up on the rights holder side and on the user side, the extent to which the work was freed up, could be an education function involved, and people would not be misled. So that's just a thought.
Yeah, interpretation and education. Instead of thinking whether it's possible, explaining how it can be possible and finding argumentations, which is way less dangerous and quicker, more effective, and less legalese, because as one of the objective explained by inviting, we don't speak to lawyers.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty useful thought. It's kind of ironic because it requires like our whole approach of having ported all those Creative Commons licenses originally, which has led to this people in those 45 or more jurisdictions around the world who are there and who understand this and probably share the intentions of CC0 as much as they share the intentions after the original Creative Commons licenses. And now you have them in place, now you can use them in order to not have to port, to do through the entire porting process. So it's kind of like the other approach was required to be able to do this. And it is, at least my understanding, for our jurisdiction project, for example, really exactly once the CC0 is out there to do that kind of work which you described. It's not just about translating it literally, maybe in Dutch, but like also bringing it out to like the user communities who need to be aware of it and might want to work with it in the Netherlands.
In some engineering specifications, in power output or something, they sometimes list a minimum, no less than. So this would be, I guess, this would be a specification that says, in a way, it's no more than giving away all rights, it may be less, and here's what there are, so it would kind of be CC0. It wouldn't be plus or minus, it would be
squiggle.
What's the size of
the CC squiggle?
What's the size of that?
Squiggle.
Yeah, then, right, okay.
Yeah, and the methodology to implement a protocol and the way to explain this knowledge to the general public who are not lawyers. I would like to know, Phil, if you have a few thoughts on how this could be conveyed. So the, instead of having an accurate legal reporting, which may be slow and difficult, conveying this interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of trying to strive for very good but not best, and then explain not only how that works, but what some of the deficiencies in individual places might be, is probably wise, because it's going to be very, very hard to get to complete perfection. The difficulty I see, and so directly into your question, but the difficulty I see is, to the extent one goal, as you say, is to try to achieve some certainty, try to give people the knowledge that, you know, if they want to use something that is licensed in this way, they can feel good about doing it, free to do it. You know, it depends a bit on your target audience. Millions and millions and millions and millions of Creative Commons licenses in use worldwide. Lots of people take great comfort from that. It would be nice if you could reach different audiences. I mean, lots of corporations and people with more to lose are often very reluctant to take advantage of Creative Commons licenses, and potentially even more so with a CC0 license. One worry, and maybe is more so now that you've split the waiver and the assertion parts, is that, you know, unlike the regular Creative Commons licenses that are just about copyright, presumably the person creating the license and saving it is most likely to be the author and the creator and own the copyright. With a CC0 license, you're quit claiming or waiving all the potential rights that may be there. And so the most obvious case would be a photograph, where if you are the photographer, you may hold the copyright and be able to waive that. But if the photograph is out somewhere else, a right of publicity claim would be held by them. And so you wouldn't necessarily be able to waive that. So when you get to the area of explanation and what people need to understand about using a license like CC0, in some ways it gets very complicated, more complicated, because you not only need to explain how it works and how some things may or may not be waivable, but there's more focus on you must be the rights holder in the first place, and if you're talking about all random rights, that can get fairly complicated. So there's a lot of work to be done to try to make these explanations and make them as clear as possible and make them ported to all the different places where they're varying.
Part of my point was that, I mean, like Phil just mentioned, rights of publicity, which, you know, are tied into U.S. law, and so, you know, while I fully appreciate that the U.S.-based subgroup isn't going to work because you're trying first and foremost really to reach the international community, I think in some way if you could focus on a subgroup, you know, so it's not geographic, but, you know, somehow try to take a step, maybe make this more incremental than you're thinking right now. I mean, I don't disagree that, yeah, it'd be great to have this end goal. It just, there's just so many, you know, and I think moral rights is a great example of an international issue, right? So you need to have, you know, who is your international lawyer who's going to weigh in on this, where just even to help you understand, you know, here in the U.S. what it is that those issues are, and then to tie into, you know, the fact that somebody in France can't give up rights that they legally can't give up. I mean, so, that might be a suggestion that I would make overall is to take it and to figure out what your intermediate step is. It's always great to have an angle, but something.
Just before giving the word to Eric, don't be afraid of more rights. Let's talk outside.
Two things. One is about corporations not using for-profit corporations not using CC, not having as much comfort in CC. one of the things we've talked about in CC is if Disney is going to take the Creative Commons work and use it, they have the opportunity, the transaction cost won't burden Disney. They can go find it who the owner is and have whatever discussion they need to. And as far as the imprecision of CC asymptote, whatever we're calling it, there's a huge amount of misunderstanding about CC licenses anyhow. When I talk about CC and go to places where people are using licenses, even among sophisticated people, there is a pretty wide understanding that Creative Commons licenses are a kind of rights laundering machine. You put them in, sign the license, and whether you had much to do with it or not, or something to do with it, and they come out clean on the other end. So that's not to say that we shouldn't be as precise as possible, but it is to say that, I actually totally turned around on this over 3 or 4 years, that we needn't be a perfect machine so long as we say we won't be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that in the field of science, and in particular of databases, what is needed from the point of view of communication is also a huge effort in dealing with the relationship between people being the author in some way of this data or works in general, and the institutions for which these people are working, or which could in some way limit their possibility to license. As for right of publicity for photographs, for databases, maybe people are not completely aware that they may be the author, but they could have been financed by someone else, and the European sui generis right would be owned by this other person. Or, for instance, I was speaking with people working in the archaeological field. In Italy, you have institutions, a governmental institution that should approve the disclosure of some information for various kind of reasons related to the safety of the archaeological sites and so on. So I think that this is a peculiar problem with science. And then it also looks strange to me that Creative Commons in some ways for science seems to be shifting from a paradigm in which the messages you choose, which is the right balance among keeping rights, licensing rights, to a party in which you seem to say, for science, you should waive everything. So it is much more similar to a message of the open source community with GPL for software. The right way is to do that. You waive certain rights. So you have just one model adapt to a certain environment. So to differences.
So you're absolutely right that this is a little bit different than with the Creative Commons licenses, where there's not an unlimited number of variations, but there's choice. And here we're making a very specific recommendation. I guess the reason for that is that one, that we are focused on science, looking at how scientists would like to share data. So maybe one thought I have is maybe that there needs to be something slightly different when it's not science. But in the scientific field, I think that given that you're dealing with primarily non-lawyers who won't spend the time to understand these issues, I think the default should be that it's something that is consistent with their the community expectations for how to use data on the one hand, and on the other hand, should not require them to become lawyers themselves to understand what they need. And a third aspect of that, I would say, is that going back to the three principles that I outlined, which has to be easy to use, has to be legally accurate to the extent that you can make it, and it has to have low transaction costs. I don't see another way, another set of recommendations that would achieve these three goals. If there were, I think, there could be added to the list of choices. But for now, given that those are the goals, that's really what we've been forced down that path is the only solution to those three design goals that we have, which we're going to be very clear when we announce this, we're going to be very clear as to what those design goals are. this is to achieve these three goals. And so this is why this is the recommendation. It's like, well, if you're building a car and a highway only gives you 12 feet, then you can't build a 13-feet trailer. So there are certain, there are enough constraints that I think that what we call the Science Commons Data Protocol, which is so it's actually this, let me step back a bit. There's something called the Science Commons Data Protocol. It's not the CC0 license. It's a set of recommendations for what a compliant waiver would look like. And so, as I said, there's actually another license or another waiver called the PDDL, Public Domain Dedication License, by the Open Data Community, that is compliant with the Science Commons Data Protocol. In the US, most of the genomics databases are compliant with the protocol because they're already public domain, or at least they have terms of use that say they're public domain. And so I'd like to sort of shift the focus a little bit from what is this thing called CC0 to what is this thing that looks like public domain. And also, by the way, 90% of the genomics and other science databases already are compliant with. So that's what we call the Science Commons Data Protocol. There are many ways to implement it. And CC0 will be just one of those ways, not the only way. But the common denominator of the Science Commons Data Protocol is to create a safe harbor where scientists who are operating within those communities that adopt these tools, whatever, how many tools there may be, can be sure that there's some basic principles that apply. One of them is that the provider is not exercising whatever proprietary rights they have to place restrictions on the way that the data can be used. The rights clearance issue is a hard issue. It's not only a hard issue, by the way, for CC0, it's a hard issue for CC licenses proper. It's a hard issue for GPL too. It's a hard issue for all open source licenses, actually. People don't understand. I mean, one of the classic problems with open source is people take something's been licensed under GPL and they put it out under BSD, right? People are not careful. And so that's not a criticism that should be leveled only against CC0. It's a criticism that's leveled against openness in general. And I think we have to solve it to the best of our ability, but I don't think it should stop us from doing it. Right.
We can decide that we can be 1 or 2 minutes late.
Oh. Well, maybe I would just say something that to put it in context of CC as well. Actually, I mean, we're talking about for the open access data protocol, we're talking about a very pretty specific genre of bits. And so we can make a very specific recommendation for how those bits need to be treated. And I think there's a continuum from something very specific like that to something like open source software, which is considerably broader than a genre of bits than scientific data. And so there's a relatively narrow set of recommendations that people use, you know, defined by the open software definition. So there's a fairly narrow band of terms that are acceptable for that genre of bits. Then expanding out to culture, that's much more heterogeneous, so there needs to be much more choice for different sorts of uses, whether that's education or filmmakers or video. And so what we recommend for that space offers much more choice, a range from very liberal to very restrictive licenses. So, and just one other thing I mentioned with regard to, because I don't think it's been mentioned yet at all, with regards to clearing rights, and I know this is something myself and Juan Carlos care a lot about is metadata, and it's another part of the CC story. We want to make sure that there's enough information attached to a work such that, you know, even if the person publishing might not know enough in order to fully determine the copyright status, if there's enough information attached to work, then people are copyright experts. in a particular jurisdiction might be able to make a determination. That'll be really important to the upcoming public domain assertion work that we'll be working on, where a curator of a work in a museum knows a lot about a work, knows a lot of facts about a work, but isn't going to be a copyright expert in Australia or whatever. But if those facts about the work are available, then then the lawyers will be able to make that determination.
Thank you very much. I think it's time to wrap up, so except if someone has an additional quick question or comment, I would like to thank you and mention that there will be discussion on the various Creative Commons lists on the topic, I guess, in the near future.